Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I swear I didn't plan this, and I don't think the president's people are checking my schedule, but on the same day that the president will travel to a Cleveland suburb to continue pitching his health care plan, and the same day the vice president is here to raise money for some politicians, we have NPR's political junkie and political editor Ken Rudin with us to tell us whether such an effort will matter this week as Congress gives it another go. Ken, you've been sick and on vacation. Welcome back.
Well, thank you. And it is a coincidence that the president is in Ohio and I'm on your program. It is a coincidence. I don't know about Biden, though. Biden probably got there because he knew of our program.
The president is in Strongsville today, or going to be there around 1 o'clock. It's that final push, they're calling it. Tell me, where does it stand now? They're saying they don't have enough votes in the House yet.
They don't have the votes. And, of course, if they had the votes, they would have passed it a long time ago. Mm-hmm. Of course, all the House had to do from the outset was to pass to vote for the Senate version that the Senate voted on Christmas Eve. Of course, there are so many more divisions in the House, and not only among Democrats and Republicans. Republicans aren't even part of this equation. Mm-hmm. It's between Democrats, and it's especially with the abortion issue is key. Bart Stupak, the pro-life Democrat from Michigan, says he has about a dozen or so Democrats who are not going to vote for it because that so-called Stupak abortion, Stupak amendment, mm-hmm. has been not part of the final package. And there are also like progressives like Dennis Kucinich, who says he's going to vote for it. And he voted against it. And he voted against it last year as well because he said it wasn't strong enough. He said there's no public option, no government controlled option. But of course, the public option was in the House bill last year, and Kucinich voted against it anyway. So obviously, Kucinich is not happy because it's not strong enough. There are pro-lifers who are not happy because it's not strong enough on abortion. And there are a lot of Democrats unhappy that the White House may not have the votes to pass it. At least they don't have it right now.
You know, one of the folks that Vice President Biden is in to raise money for today is a U.S. rep from the Cincinnati area, Driehaus. Okay. And he is not going to vote for the bill because of the abortion issue.
Right. He was on board last year because of the Stupak amendment. But it was clear what happened last year was that Nancy Pelosi gave this wink and nod to Bart Stupak and the pro-life Democrats and said, look, sure, you can have this amendment and we'll keep it in the bill, knowing full well that, one, the Senate would never go along with it, and two, when it came to final merging of the two bills, that language wouldn't be there. So, of course, there are a lot of people Nancy Pelosi didn't need the votes last year because she knew that she had enough to pass it. Now she really desperately needs the Driehauses and the Kuciniches and the Boucheris, who's also John Boucheri. Mm-hmm. The freshman Democrat from Ohio, who's also being under tremendous pressure to vote for it, but she and the president may not have those votes.
I depending on what you're reading, passing the health care measure would devastate Democratic chances in the fall, or rejecting it would devastate a Democratic presidency.
Right.
It's the classic, darned if you do and darned if you don't.
Well, you don't really know what's going to happen. I mean, you think of, a lot of people say that the Republicans are up for, a thrashing at the polls if they block health care. But the Republicans blocked health care in 1994, and they won control of the House with Newt Gingrich for the first time in 40 years. A lot has to do with how the Democrats spin it. I mean, if they get it passed, Republicans say that a lot of these Democrats who were elected in Republican areas in 2006 and 2008 are going to be very, very vulnerable. But if they reject it, it's very possible that they could blame Democrats since they have a majority in the House and Senate. If they couldn't get it passed with all these majorities, then, what good are having the Democrats in control? So you're absolutely right. It's like a catch-22 for the Democrats. But given the choices, I'm sure the Democrats would rather have it pass than not pass.
Speaking of the majority, have the Republicans succeeded or failed in sort of demonizing that simple majority vote that the Democrats are going to go for?
Well,
it's kind of petered out, the criticism of that.
Yes, but you also look at the polls, and the polls show that most people feel that it will, first of all, 85% polls do show that 85% of the American people are satisfied with their health care coverage and their insurance coverage. But for the 15% who is not, some of the stories are just horrific. And of course, one of the reasons that President Obama is going to Strongsville is also this woman who talked about how her life savings were just wiped out and how it's just ruined her whole life because of all the expenses and the additions and the increases in health care coverage. So, you have all all those stories you want, but if a majority of people still feel that their taxes will be raised, the cost will be prohibitive, and the quality of health care will not be as good as it would have been had it not been passed.
You know, what does a trip like to Ohio today do for the for his case then?
Well, there's not much else he can do. I mean, of course, you know, the fact, this is what's so amazing about this whole thing, the fact that he was so willing, very willing, to go on his trip to Indonesia and Guam mm-hmm. and Australia at the end of the week before the vote was cast just shows that there are Democrats that say, we desperately need you here. Look, he is not Lyndon Johnson. He is not the kind of arm twister. And, of course, Lyndon Johnson twisted more than just arms. You know, when he grabbed you, he didn't grab you by the arm. But the thing is, it's just Obama, they feel he should be much more engaged and much more, I mean, he could give great speeches, he can raise money for Democrats, but he just doesn't seem to have the pull, especially with his numbers down, that one would think of a new president.
Now, if you're just joining us, my guest is Ken Rudin. He is the NPR political editor. You may know him as the Political Junkie. We'll take some calls after the first break. But before then, I wanted to ask you about the issue of unions and how they weigh in when it comes to the health reform measure. They're threatening to pull support and that kind of thing from Democrats that don't vote for it.
Yeah, well, the unions don't have the power they used to have, obviously. I mean, there are so many Democrats who have voted for NAFTA despite threats from unions. And aside from one or two, I remember there was a couple of years ago, there was an incumbent in Ohio, actually, who lost his Democratic primary a bid for renomination because of his support for NAFTA. But for the most part, they don't have the power they do have. But what seems the group that seems to have the most power, certainly financially, is the Chamber of Commerce, which is spending a ton of money, an unheard of amount of money, in the this month, for one thing. But this week, it's just they expect to spend millions and millions of dollars badgering or trying to persuading some 40 Democrats either to vote against it. So there's a tremendous amount of money. Most of it's spent on the opposition side to health care. But the lobbying that's going on, unions, yes, but Chamber of Commerce even mm-hmm. more so. Tremendous week going on right now.
You know, there was a plan bandied about last week to pair the college aid bill with the health care measure.
Yeah, and that's probably going to be part of it, too.
Okay.
And I think that Nancy Pelosi's argument is that it'll sweeten the deal for some of the Democrats who are on the fence.
Right, and that is what would take that middleman bank out of the Pell Grant process.
That's exactly right, and I think, and then there are some Democrats who are persuaded that it's a more palatable vote to sell to the voters back home, saying this is another reason why I voted for the bill.
You know, another question regarding the message, because there's a new Gallup poll out that found that health care ranks behind unemployment and the economy in what Americans care about right now. But health care is a part of the economy. It is a part of unemployment, the unemployment issue. How do Americans separate those three issues from each other that way?
Well, Republicans, I think, are doing a good job of it. And I think talk radio, certainly conservative talk radio, is doing a good job of it in that they say that, well, look, President Obama promised jobs would be number one, number two, and number three on his priority. And when you have a tremendous recession going on right now and all the people losing their jobs, it should be the employment stuff that the president should be focusing on. But of course, at the same time, when you lose your job, you also lose your insurance coverage, and you get a double whammy. And so the Democrats will argue that this obviously helps the insurance of the employment situation, because obviously with health coverage, you're less likely to lose the job, or at least you're less likely to suffer the consequences of losing your job by losing unemployment your health insurance as well.
We have an email from a listener who writes, if the American people get fed up enough with the inability of Congress to enact legislation, do you think there might be a grassroots movement to change the U.S. Constitution, such as require all votes about bills before either House of Congress be by a simple majority, eliminating the filibustering in the Senate, or disallow any bill more than one major subject? That's been tried before.
Well, the filibuster stuff is of course, coming up strong, because it seems to be there have been more votes that need a 60-vote majority in the Senate since 2007. So that's 3 or 4 years. In the last 3 years, than there had been in 80 years before that. So it's really it's no longer majority rule, and I think that's why the Democrats are pushing for reconciliation. Mm-hmm. That's the process by which ultimately the final vote on health care would be by a majority rule. But no no party wants to eliminate the filibuster because they know that one day that the majority will be the minority and vice versa. So for all the the complaints that the Republicans were making about why can't we get an up and down vote on Bush judgeships, in 2004, 2005, then now they're saying that you need 60. Back then they were saying for a simple majority they wanted to have a simple majority to pass the Bush judges, confirmation of the judges. So just be careful that you don't want to pass anything like that to limit the minority, especially when you're in the majority, because as it turns out, you could become a minority very quickly.
What about the earmarks war? Who's winning that?
Well, a lot of it, I think a lot of people think it's just for show. I think the Democrats were too quiet on it for too long, and they, and then they started, realizing that I think, it might be a good PR thing for November, but for the Republicans to complain about it or complain about the lack of Democratic leadership on earmarks, kind of falls flat, because for all the years they were in power, and we know about the earmarks and the special deals that the Republicans got when they controlled Congress. So I think with all that's going on now, the jobs bill, perhaps immigration reform, climate change that the Democrats would love to pass, and of course the health care bill, earmarks, I think, is just a minor diversion.
If the president can't get this health care bill through, does it have a domino effect on the climate change, on immigration reform, on all the other stuff he wants to do?
Well, you could answer that question both ways, even if it passes. This is kind of a spurious argument, but let's just make it anyway. If the Democrats push through health care by a reconciliation, by a majority vote, now Republicans saying, well, we now have no longer any incentive of working with Democrats to pass things like immigration changes or jobs bill. But the Democrats will say, wait a second, where have you been all along? What cooperation are you promising? There has been none so far. That's why the financial regulation bill that Chris Dodd is pushing through, he's given up on working with Republicans because the Republicans are obviously not going to come on board. It's perhaps the most poisoned, everybody who follows politics for a long time always likes to say, well, this is the worst in history, the worst ever. We've never seen anything like this before. But there's truth to that in what's going on in Washington now. It just doesn't work. The chemistry is not there. The distrust is completely, in the old days, Democrats and Republicans could argue all they want on the House floor, the Senate floor, and meet afterwards and go out for a drink and talk about legislation. Mm-hmm. We saw that with civil rights. We saw that with tons of bills. We saw that with tax reform, with Bob Dole and Bob Packwood and Dan Rostenkowski in the 1980s. We don't see any of that now.
We're going to have to take a short break. My guest is Ken Rudin. He's the NPR political editor. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
And you're listening to WOSU 820 NPR News. Hear more from WOSU anytime at WOSU.org. Listen to All Sides with Ann Fisher whenever you want with the online archive. Podcast new and archived shows from all the guests and topics. Podcast All Sides at WOSU.org/allsides. And remember, it's simple and easy to renew your WOSU membership. Just go online to WOSU.org and click on the Pledge Now box along the left margin. Whether you're a first-time member or looking to renew your membership, your online gift is more important than ever. Visit WOSU.org and thank you for your support. 42 degrees in downtown Columbus, cloudy skies today and a high right around 45. Clouds tonight, a low of 35 degrees. Sunshine promised for Tuesday and a high of 52. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Ken Rudin. He's the political junkie from NPR, where he is really their political editor. Ken, you mentioned the conservative broadcasters a few minutes ago, and it got me thinking about Glenn Beck and calling on Christians to leave their churches if they heard any preaching about social or economic justice.
You didn't mean social justice. You mean socialism and communism and fascism.
What's happening?
Well, what's happening with Glenn Beck? Or what's happening? Well, You know, there was an interesting piece in the Washington Post today
by
Harry Kurtz about basically there are a lot of people at Fox News, and I know this for this is absolutely true, that there are a lot of people, as bad as a lot of people feel about Fox News, there are a lot of people at Fox News who are horrified at the antics of Glenn Beck that go on every day. It's, you know, it's one thing to say, well, he's not a journalist, he's opinionated, but it's over the line opinionated. I mean, it's like, you know, in the 1960s, we didn't have a John Birch Society or a Communist Party member, spewing out stuff on a news network.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not comparing Glenn Beck to the John Birch Society or the Communist Party, but it is so incendiary, and it's beyond the pale in a lot of things he said. And I just know that a lot of conservatives who work for Fox just, you know, roll their eyes and say, you know, we'll never get any respect. We'll never get any kind of sense. And nobody will ever have the sense that we are a legitimate news organization. And a lot of people don't feel they are because of people like O'Reilly and Hannity, but especially Glenn Beck, who he just goes beyond, you know, civil discourse and just calls people, you know, he hates white people, and he's a socialist, and it's I've never seen it. Here we go again. Another thing I've never seen before.
Well, I mean, and the pushback too from the religious right even is pretty interesting.
Oh yeah, and it's just, you know, and they you know, look, he's bringing in a ton of money, and he's, you know, getting great ratings, but at the same time, there's a growing boycott against Fox News because of some of the things that goes on there, and even members of the religious right saying, wait a second, this is not the way, you know, we're going to win a majority, win over the American people by just people see him as clownish and buffoonish, and he's a great, you know, he's a great actor, but. You know, you put him on a sitcom or something, but don't put him in a news organization that's trying to be legitimate.
Let's take a call right now if you want to talk with Ken Rudin, 614-292-8513. And Dale, you're on the air. You wanted to talk about how the health care bill might help your business or hurt it?
It's a true story about how the health care situation has affected a small business,
okay,
a family-owned business. And by the way, I've been a poli-sci junkie most of my life. But this is a true story, and this involves a small business. They celebrated their 50th year in 08. But in 06, we had a very, very good policy, health insurance policy as a group, small business.
Mm-hmm.
And I was told by people in the industry that it was a very, very good policy. But in the spring of 06, the entire policy for the entire business was canceled. And it was due to, according to them, the fact that we only had, 10 or 12 people on the policy. Well, as it turned out, there were four people there with cancer, and there were a number of people with other medical-related high blood pressure, mm-hmm, had heart attacks, stuff like that. As it turned out, after the policy was canceled, all those people who had pre-existing conditions were covered under the new policy. And over a period of time, five of them had passed away, and the year they celebrated their 50th year, the business was destroyed in fire. So,
well, what do you make of what's happening now, though? I mean, is what the president has proposed, is that something that you can support?
I have supported health care reform in any form.
Why do you think so many people oppose it? Lots of small business owners too.
Because it's the loud, extreme voices of the Glenn Becks and the conservatives, and really it's about money. It's about power. It's about being reelected. It's about trying to make everybody happy, but you can't. And the one thing that I do know is that when Barack Obama makes people mad on both sides, I'm pretty sure he's doing the right thing.
Okay,
because
thanks, Dale.
You're not going to make everybody happy.
What do you think, Ken? Does that?
Well, I can't talk about the specifics about, you know, small businesses, mm-hmm, and how they will fare or not fare under the new health care bill. But I think the thing he's saying about Barack Obama is exactly true, because the right thinks he's, you know, he's a socialist sellout who is just, you know, masking a moderate image, but, you know, pushing through a very radical agenda, while the left saying that, you know, this guy Obama has sold out to the corporate interest, and, you know, he talks a good game, but ultimately he's just afraid of confrontation. Just like, you know, a lot of Democrats for months have been saying, forget let's go to reconciliation from the beginning. Let's pass it. Let's just, you know, if we can't get Republicans, the heck with them. But I think Obama, being a community organizer or somebody who's just so, you know, when he campaigned for the presidency, he was very careful. And I don't want to put words in his mouth, but the way I saw it was very careful not to be another Jesse Jackson. He did not want a white country to see this African-American coming up and say, oh, here we are with another Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson. He was so quiet about race. He was so quiet about confrontation that he just didn't want to make waves. And I think that a campaign style that suited him during the campaign doesn't suit him as president because, as I said, while he's not Lyndon Johnson, he has health care hanging in the balance, and a lot of progressives feel that what he has to do is take charge, and that means just, you know, twist arms and just say, look, you know, forget about it. Forget about any kind of help from the party if you're going to vote against this measure. And now Nancy Pelosi has said you got to have profiles and courage. You can't let politics take over. But how could you tell members of Congress who are up for re-election every 2 years not to be concerned about politics? They got here because of politics.
But they've always had, thanks a lot, Dale, for your call. They've always had 2-year terms. Nothing's changed about that. That's not new.
No, that's not, exactly. But for Nancy Pelosi and Barack Obama say, don't worry about politics,
yeah.
Forget about put aside your best interest. How could you tell them to do that? It's just, you know, in the history of Congress, very few people have done that. There have been some heroes in the past, for example, Southern lawmakers who voted for civil rights when it wasn't popular, and they mm-hmm. ultimately paid the price. But the Democrats owe their majority, which they got in 2006, to a lot of blue dog Democrats who were elected in Republican districts mm-hmm. in 2006 and 2008. And basically, they're asking them to risk their whole careers by voting for something that may not be popular back home. And that's a tough call for many of these lawmakers.
Let's take another call, 614-292-8513. Tom, you may want to turn down your radio. Okay. Tom?
Yes, hi.
Turn down your radio, and you're on the air. You want to talk about those town hall meetings last August?
Right. Real quick, just want to take a moment to disagree with the last caller. In regards to the president taking a stance on race, I thought his speech after the Reverend Wright blow-up on race was incredibly powerful and bold. So, you know, I don't know where he's coming from on that.
Well, that wasn't our last caller. That was
that
Ken
was
Rudin,
me.
Our guest.
But he had no choice then. But by the time he had that speech, I agree with you, that was an amazing speech in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It was something that people have been asking for the longest time. But remember, that came after a drumbeat of stuff on Reverend Wright that was threatening to not only, you know, end his chances for the presidency, but end his chances for the nomination. The Hillary Clinton people loved the controversy over Reverend Wright, and they were, you know, they were fermenting it as much as the Republicans were. So, yes,
right,
he did
but
get
were,
that
I mean,
speech.
They were, the Clinton campaign was, you know, soft-stepping around race just as well. I mean, President Clinton got into some hot water with some comments, so, you know, I don't
he
think
sure
you
did
can
in
put
South
that,
Carolina,
that race
right?
issue. Mm-hmm. Right, you can't put that race issue all on Mr. Obama. But my main point is in calling. I spoke with you briefly. I didn't get to finish my point back in, I believe it was September. Might have been last time you were on. Just to preface this, I'm not really a fan of much of the media, and I'm in particular not a fan of you in regards to the fact that during the whole dust-up, during the town hall meetings in August regarding health care, there was this so-called grassroots drive that was fomenting all this fear and loathing about the president's health care proposal. Very little investigative and real journalism was done to discover what was the cause of that. It was called grassroots, but organizations like FreedomWorks were very, very deeply involved. These are very highly skilled professional organizations that lobby and gin up this fear. Now, the example is, and it was said that, you know, this fear was genuine. People were genuinely scared about what was going to happen with their health care mm-hmm. options. The thing is, if an organization went out there and campaigned as hard as these organizations did to drum up the fear in Americans that if they didn't do something, they were going to be attacked in their home by tigers. If they were robocalled, if they had all these, you know, people just screaming at the top of their lungs in their congressman's
You mean
face,
no matter whatever the issue is, they can spend the money and spend the right. And exercise the power to scare people.
And the thing is, what wasn't really reported is, although the fear, I could say that fear of being attacked in my home by a tiger was real. You know, I've got this because I've been convinced this fear is genuine, mm-hmm. but it's not based in reality. And the reporting wasn't done. The only person that I saw do real actual reporting on this was Rachel Maddow on MSNBC. She dug into the facts. She really got into the heart of things and really explored that. You in particular and many
what can respond,
in the media
Tom?
Just regurgitate things.
Ken, why don't you respond?
Well, let's see, several things. First mm-hmm. of all, I think there is a lot of ignorance out there, and I think a lot of it is fomented by groups like Freedom Works who would obviously have an agenda there. But I think you're dismissing the anger, a lot of it is out of ignorance. When I say ignorance, I don't mean they're ignorant. I mean they just don't know what's going on, and they've been fed a lot of facts, or so-called facts. But I think you're dismissing a lot of this is exactly what formed the Tea Party. And I think the Tea Party people are just disillusioned. They're afraid. They may be afraid because there's a black man in the presidency, or they're afraid that their health care won't look the same, or things will change. A lot of people are just fearful of change. I'm not. You could disagree with me all you want, but I don't believe. I think that, yes, there were groups like Dick Armey and the Freedom Works and all that people stirring up trouble. But I think there was a growing fear about so many things changing so soon. Bailouts of all the auto companies, bailouts of banks and financial institutions, a complete overhaul of the healthcare system, that people were frightened. They were sure there were rabble rousers like Freedom Works who fed on this, but to dismiss the town hall anger and the Tea Party folks is just a false grassroots or spurring up, I think you do them a disservice. Now I agree the media should have been much stronger and not allowing the Sarah Palins of the world to come on and say, well, you know, grandma is dead if you pass this thing. And a lot of us just, you know, rolled our eyes. We shouldn't have been rolling our eyes. We should have been saying this is absolutely not true. And I agree with you. The media has failed in that regard. But I still think that you're dismissing and diminishing a genuine grassroots fear, uncertainty, concern what's going on in the country.
You know, conversely, there's the anti-message out there that you know, Freedom Works and others worked hard to propagate. But there's also been criticism of how the Obama people established the message in the first place, that they didn't come out strong enough and hard enough.
Well, not only that, I mean, first of all, and we've said this on the show, and I don't know if this is what Tom is referring to, but one of the things I keep saying on is that from the very beginning, Barack Obama was determined not to repeat the so-called mistakes of the Clintons of 93 and 94. Clinton's basically was my way or the highway with health care back then. And, of course, many of their fellow Democrats were nervous about it, skittish about it. And, of course, the health care industry, as we saw with the Harry and Louise ads, spent a fortune scaring a lot of people away. But Obama didn't want to do that. He wanted to leave it all to Congress. And the stuff that did happen with Congress, with the Louisiana Purchase, with Mary Landrieu's vote and the Cornhusker thing, whatever, with Ben Nelson's vote, it just turned off a lot of people. And you had the Mitch McConnells and the Dick Armeys of the world saying, this is just, you know, well, of course, this is the way that Congress always has worked. But they felt it was really like, you know, legalized bribery. And so a lot of talking points, people started talking about Louisiana Purchase and Cornhusker stuff because they heard it on Fox News over and over again. They heard it on the radio over and over again. And so it seems to work.
614-292-8513. If you want to give a call, talk to Ken Rudin, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Jesse, you're on the air. You want to talk about the Democrats in Congress who might lose in the fall?
Yeah. I worked for an organization that helped get some of the folks here in Ohio elected, and I know some of them have only been in there for a couple years.
Mm-hmm. Who are you talking about?
Mary Jo Kilroy.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I wasn't directly involved, but Driehaus down in Cincinnati was also somebody our organization advocated.
Those are two big ones to watch, absolutely.
But, you know, you mentioned in 1992, Congress was scared to go with the my way or the highway thing. They got voted out anyway. I mean, I think the Democrats need to step out whether they're going to lose their jobs or not. And, I mean, this plan is so watered down. I don't see, other than Kucinich's stance, much reason to argue. But you mentioned earlier, you know, the folks that voted for the Civil Rights Act and caught some flack for it in the South.
Well, they lost their seats.
So, yeah, since you're the historical expert on the politics, I mean, isn't it better to have a legacy in politics where you voted for something that was right and good and lose your job over it? I mean, it seems like that could be something you could campaign for 2 years or 4 years later, as opposed to something that's going to be a bloody spot on your shirt. Oh, for.
I agree with everything you just said. I absolutely agree. The whole, I mean, just the idea of Profiles in Courage to stand up and say, look, I may, this may not be the most popular thing, but it's right for America, it's right for my district, it's right for my state, and if I lose, so what? And you also make a good point. Even the Democrats even the Republicans who fought against health care got the benefit in 1994 by sweeping Congress. It wasn't only because of health care, but there was a lot of Clinton stuff that just nobody seemed to like. But I agree with you. I mean, Nancy Pelosi, for all her lack of, she may not be the strongest speaker in my lifetime or the history of the House, but she does make a very good point, saying that this is a thing. You know, a lot of Republicans saying, why are you going to rush this through? We've been talking about health care since Truman, or not you and I, Ann, but right. Fred and I were. Fred and I used to do it since Truman. But, I mean, to say they're rushing it through is just nuts. So I agree completely with Jesse that on any issue where a conscience is facing off against the political edge to it, I think conscience, you know, when you ultimately, when you meet your maker at the end and you explain what you did, I think voting your conscience rather than voting to get reelected is always the right way to go. Absolutely.
Thanks for your call, Jesse.
Thank you.
We're going to have to take another short break. My guest is Ken Rudin of NPR. He is the political editor at NPR. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. I'll try to get to all those calls and emails as soon as we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820, NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, legal correspondent Jeffrey Toobin explains the inner workings of our nation's highest court, who writes opinions and why, what the Supreme Court has to do with the future of gun control, and the implications of the expected retirement of Justice Stevens. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Get the latest information from WOSU the way you want it, daily, biweekly, or monthly. Go to wosu.org/email to sign up for one of our e-newsletters.
Support for WOSU comes from The Other Paper, Columbus's news and entertainment weekly, on newsstands every Thursday and online at theotherpaper.com.
WOSU Public Media and the Women's Fund of Central Ohio present the Keyholder 10 event featuring Academy Award-winning actress and director Diane Keaton, Wednesday, May 12th at the Ohio Theater. More information is available at womensfundcentralohio.org. 42 degrees in downtown Columbus, clouds today. There is a slight chance of rain and a high right around 45. Clouds tonight, a low of 35 degrees, sunshine on Tuesday and a high of 52. All Sides continues on WOSU 820.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Ken Rudin of NPR. He's the political editor there. You might know him as the political junkie. Ken, we were talking about the Tea Party movement a few minutes ago. What about the Coffee Party movement? What do you make of that?
Well, I understand what they're trying to do, and obviously they're trying to put a more moderate image than the Tea Party folks. But if you notice that lately, the Tea Party people have been talking less and less about abortion and social issues and less about the John McCain. I think down in their heart of hearts, the Tea Party may be more Ross Perot than Republican Party and Sarah Palin. And I know there's no leadership there. I mean, there's 8 million Tea Parties. There's no leader. There's no organization. There's no one philosophy fits all. So I know what the Coffee Party is trying to do, but I think there's some members of the Tea Party who feel the same way, that they feel that being identified as Republicans, being identified as Sarah Palin folks, is defeating their purpose. That I think that whatever power and leverage they have would go away, of course, if they became just an arm or a tool of the Republican Party. Can I say one more thing?
Sure.
I was thinking of opening up the show by saying a stupid joke, like I'm tickled to be here, and you know, a little Eric Masser joke. But you know, it was interesting that not one call and you know, when I was on vacation, I was first I was sick for a long week, mm-hmm. and then I was on vacation, and everybody just sent me emails. Oh, you're missing Eric and Massa. You're missing Eric Massa. Great story, great story, great story. Meanwhile, nobody has sent me an email question about Eric Massa. Nobody cares about that. They think it's one of the things that the media love to do is just focus on peccadilloes that are titillating, and they miss the whole story. So I'm just throwing in a little compliment to your audience that nobody's bothering with the stupid stories, you know, the Riel Hunters of the world, the Eric Masters of the world, and talking about what really matters to people and their futures.
Okay, I'm crossing those things off. Right?
No, I'll talk about it, but I'm just saying, it's an amazing story. But people are saying, look, you know, Eric Masters is funny, and it's a great story, and it's a pathetic story. I mean, there's nothing funny about it.
But it's no Mark Foley.
Well, I mean, you know what's so funny, what's so weird about this and so typical of the way Washington works is that, of course, the Republican Party came out with, Nancy Pelosi promised to clean the cesspool of Washington. And here we have David Paterson of New York and Charlie Rangel of New York and Eric Massa and all that stuff. So the Democrats come back and say, well, what about John Ensign and Mark Sanford? So I expect the Republicans are talking about Dan Roskakowski. I think we're going to go back to Teapot Dome and Ulysses S. Grant,
no.
The way they keep doing these things.
There is no shortage of scandal on either side of the aisle.
No.
That's for sure. And the Hunter thing. But you've already told me you won't talk about John Edwards anymore. So I wasn't going to bring that.
I will not say his name. No. Okay. No. I mean, you know, enough already. It's just so just yikes. And of course, she has a new interview in GQ magazine,
right,
that is in every newspaper in the country. And God help us.
It's Blogsville, USA. Mm-hmm. Let's take another call if you want to talk to Ken Rudin, 614-292-8513. And caller, you're on there. You want to talk about, is it a theory you have about why the media was slow to address those loud voices last summer?
Well, I don't so much have a theory, except that I think it goes to being corporate to some degree and perhaps corporate influence. But I'm more wondering why the media was so slow to address it, and why we seem to be in this era of the first person to the microphone or the first person in front of a camera, and these shrill voices, maybe some would say particularly from the right, but I can remember a time when it was from the left. And I'm wondering why or if this is ever going to end. You know, are we going to get back to a time when there's more substance to what we see with respect to news?
Ken?
I feel that for that question because I suspect the answer is no. This weekend I saw the movie Green Zone. It's about basically the myth or the illusion of weapons of mass destruction and how the media just bought into what the government told them about reasons for going to war. Now you could argue whether the Bush lied or just cherry picked intelligence. I'm of the latter group, but either way, the media didn't do its job. And as fewer and fewer newspapers are surviving, as fewer and fewer people are watching network television, And you wonder why that is, because actually you don't really wonder why it is, because what you're seeing is not news. It's sensationalism. And it's, and if, you know, somebody yells out at a town hall meeting that Arlen Specter is a fascist, or Claire McCaskill is a fascist, which is what we saw last summer. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, that was played over and over again on television, not the people who are behind the scenes with horror stories about their own lives and how much they need health care and what they're doing to make things work, or the people in Congress who are trying to negotiate, you know, I mean, Max Baucus, Charlie Grassley, all those people who tried to reach across the aisle to get something that both sides could be happy with. But nobody seems to be happy with anything. There's no reason to compromise. There's no reason to reach across the aisle, because ultimately their party base doesn't want them to. Everybody says that they hate the partisanship, but if you look at what's going on, I mean, look at Blanche Lincoln in Arkansas. Now, she has, of course, she's a centrist, and she's been a little cozy with the pharmaceutical agent industry, but the left went after her just like the right has been going after most of the Republicans. They say that, you know, she's sold out, and now there's a major a candidate against her in the May Democratic primary, Bill Holder, the lieutenant governor. So both sides really complain about the lack of comity in Congress, and yet ultimately the left and right really likes it the way it is.
Thanks,
Carl. Will this polarity never end? I mean, it just seems like it's a sickness.
It is a sickness, and it's ugly. And there are fewer and fewer people on Capitol Hill today who remember the old days when Bob Dole and Howard Baker and Dick Gephardt and the others would just, you know, sit and talk after working hours to try to fashion something together. When you have the people at Fox TV and MSNBC, and a lot of people say that I shouldn't be equating the two, but the point is that there are loudspeakers from the left and right who you don't have to worry about compromising or seeking moderation, because there are megaphones for those people on the right and left to just be screaming all the time. I'm very pessimistic about it. I don't know what the answer is, because some of the best newspapers in the world are ending bureaus and closing mm-hmm. down and losing circulation. And if we don't have a good newspapers, and then where we get our news from? We get it from tabloids and screaming people on cable TV.
And which is one thing that wasn't around back during the Teapot Dome scandal. You know,
no,
I mean,
no,
there
no,
wasn't that immediacy.
But not even, right, exactly, not even during the 1980s. I mean, that's right. Why you could have the welfare reform bills or the tax compromises that you certainly can't have today.
It was the same way in Ohio with the Republicans and the Democrats back in the 80s as well. They talked about things afterwards.
Oh, well, think of Ray Bliss. I mean, if you think mm-hmm. of the architect of the Republican Party in Ohio, Ray Bliss in the 50s and 60s was somebody who was never an ideologue. I mean, he was just out for a good government, but of course, good Republican government. But now Ray Bliss doesn't even exist in the Republican Party anymore.
Caller, thanks for your call.
Thank you for your work.
You bet. Let's see, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And we have an email from Debbie. She writes, when addressing health care, why is the focus on the bad guy insurance companies and not the doctors and pharmaceuticals that drive up the costs of what insurance companies have to pay in claims?
Well, actually, that's an interesting point, and an important point, because remember when I think it was some group in California who raised it 35%, and of course, you know, and they said, well, look, yes, it sounds unconscionable, but doctors' fees and pharmaceutical fees are just going up. It's not just us who are unilaterally raising fees. It's almost like a, you know, we're just part of that chain. And
it's like an inflation of fees.
It is. And of course, it remains to be seen whether there was a caller earlier who said that this is basically a pretty tame health care bill, not much different than what passed in Massachusetts. And I don't see people jumping out of their windows in Massachusetts over the kind of health care they have. And there's universal coverage in Massachusetts. But the point is that there are a lot of people at fault, and of course everybody's finger pointing, but it remains to be seen whether any kind of overhaul, especially the one that may pass this week or next week, will change that at all.
Okay, let's take another call. Michael, you're on the air. You want to talk about a timeline regarding Baucus?
Yeah, First of all, I just want to say I agree with the person who mentioned Rachel Maddow's research into the loud voices and the corporate sponsorship of those loud voices. But I think you and Ken, in rebutting that or responding to that, I think you both forgot about the enormous months of bipartisan effort that Baucus did. He had a 3-vote majority in his committee, and yet he decided to do it with 6. 3 Republicans, 3 Democrats, I believe, were the numbers. And it ended up being a sad mistake because it gave Dick Armey and those with negative views and just didn't want anything to push more of their misinformation. But you forget Obama had so much, was showing so much executive power in trying to just save the banking and credit system that he allowed basically Congress to try to work out a compromise. It worked to our disadvantage because it would have been better if he just rammed it like everything else. But it's really business that needs this health insurance reform because we're competing with countries whose workers have health insurance. And so like GM, they always had to add extra money. And so I'd like to really to address again Maddow's contention. And, you know, that really I think if people are explained the individual items in this bill, they understand that it's necessary and it needs to be tweaked in the future.
Okay.
Well, the last thing he said, Michael said, was also very important.
Mm-hmm.
Just because they pass something this week, assuming they pass something this week, doesn't mean it can't be changed. If there's some imperfections, if something isn't addressed, here I'm about to say, why can't Congress fix it? But that goes back to the problem with Congress to begin with. Why can't so many things be fixed? Because it's not the kind of Congress that it was not my father's Congress and your father's Congress. It's not the kind of Congress we used to know.
Well, when you're talking about tweaking things, though, isn't that a lot different than some big, gigantic bill? I mean, you can start tweaking around the edges once you have something on paper.
Right.
That's been
but
passed.
Of course, but at the same time, you also may not have anything get passed beyond this year because it's an election year, and you're going to probably have far more Republicans in the House and Senate come November 2010 than you have now, and that might even, you know, the chances of any kind of tweaking or changing, correcting may be going to go out the window. So we're back to another election where another stalemate. And, you know, it's interesting because given what happened in 2006 and 2008, Democrats had the votes and certainly had the momentum and had the American people behind them to get it passed, and yet because Lieberman objected to this and because Blanche Lincoln objected to that and Ben Nelson objected to that, it just went on for months and months and months. Had they passed it by their last August deadline, I think you wouldn't be in this mess now where we're counting, you know, individual votes like we are now.
Thanks.
They had the votes back then, they could have passed it.
Thanks for your call, Michael. I wanted to ask you about the Super Tuesday coming up in May. They're saying that what happens that day, I guess it's May 18th, will tell us about, how people are feeling about the Republicans and the Democrats heading into the November midterm elections. Do you feel strongly about that?
No, not at all.
Okay.
Only because I remember on January 19th, when Scott Brown won in Massachusetts, basically the word was that every Democrat in the country was in trouble and the Republicans are going to sweep everything from Hawaii to Vermont, and of course they weren't. People get swept away by the news of the day, and Scott Brown and, of course, New Jersey and Virginia last November were good news for the Republican Party, and therefore people said, oh, my God, the Democrats are finished. I have a sense that the Democrats are coming back in some sense, and I still think, though, that passage, if it happens, if they can regain the message, which they had, you know, they had the megaphone in early 2009 when Obama was, you know, in office just a couple of months. They seem to have forfeited that. They seem to, you know, whether it's the Dick Armeys of the world, whether it's the Fox News of the world. The point is, if there's a majority opinion feeling that health care is the way to go, then let's hear that voice. And so far, we're not hearing the voice. I don't know if it's a lack of money. I don't know if it's a lack of political will. I don't know if it's a lack because you have these Democrats who are so fearful about being reelected in November. But the point is that this is crunch time, and, you know, they're going to have to stand up on the vote, whether it's Friday or Saturday in the House. They're going to have to stand up for, you know, and say, look, this is exactly what's right for my constituents in my state.
Do you have any predictions about Senator Arlen Specter? He switched from Republican to Democrat last spring. This is,
well,
I guess he's
the
primary.
The only reason he switched is because he was going to get clobbered in the Republican primary by Pat Toomey and, you know, his brother Saka Toomey. They're very close together. And, of course, now he's favored. He's been backed by the Democratic establishment in Pennsylvania. President Obama, Governor Ed Rendell, all back Specter. But there are a lot of liberal Democrats, progressive Democrats, who remember his grilling of
yeah, I know. What's her name?
Yes, good old.
Oh, darn it.
Come on. 1991.
I read the book. It'll come to us.
Clarence Thomas and
Anita Hill.
Anita Hill, thank you. Anita Hill. And so there are a lot of things, you know, and of course, he, you know, he campaigned with George W. Bush in 2004. He looks like he's favored to win the nomination, and there's a new poll that shows him leading the Republican opponent as well. But there are some people, certainly Republicans, but Democrats too, said, look, you know, Arlen Specter has been in the Senate since 1980. He's always been about Arlen Specter and nothing else. And I think if you're a true progressive, you vote for Joe Sestak in the primary. But it looks like that Sestak will be outnumbered because of money and support, organizational support, and Specter should win the primary. But if he loses, boy, that'll send shockwaves. But, you know, it sends shockwaves when Ned Lamont beat Joe Lieberman in 2006. And, of course, that lasted for about a month or two because Lieberman ultimately won as an independent.
We have about 2.5 minutes left with Ken Rudin. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. And right now, Keith, you're on the air. You want to talk about that filibuster again. You wonder, why isn't it, what do you mean by why isn't it exercised the way it used to be?
Oh, I know exactly what he means.
Okay.
But I'll let
Keith
say it. But
I'd heard Chuck Todd mention that there was some sort of an agreement between the leaders of the Senate at some time ago that they wouldn't actually make senators stand on the floor of the Senate and exercise the filibuster. Is there any truth to that, or can you explain why they don't have senators exercise the filibuster in that fashion?
You know, I'm as mystified as you. You think, look, there's a romantic view of the filibuster with Jimmy Stewart, mm-hmm. and there's a despicable view of the filibuster with Strom Thurmond and civil rights bills. So, you know, filibusters work both ways. But whatever they used to make, if you filibustered, if you opposed it, you stood on the floor, held the floor, and made your case. Now there's a wink and a nod between both parties. And I don't know why I thought the same thing. I don't know why Harry Reid just doesn't make the Republicans just stand up and just filibuster the bill. But I guess they feel that one day, and maybe as soon as 2010, although I don't think it's going to happen, but they could be in minority and they'll have to filibuster. I think everybody's afraid of everything. Everybody's afraid of looking bad, and by being afraid of everything, they look bad. So I agree with you. I don't know why they don't
change.
What?
When did that start to change?
Well, it started to change. It's hard to say, but I guess it was sort of like towards the end of the Clinton administration, okay. when the Republicans held up the Clinton judicial nominees.
Right.
Then the Democrats responded by holding up the Bush nominees. And now the Republicans are holding up basically everything in Senate. It just gets worse and worse and worse. And to say what started it is, you know, is pointless. The point is, it just nothing seems to work. And, you know, for somebody like Jimmy Stewart, I don't know why he or a female Jimmy Stewart, why he or she would ever get into the politics, run for the Senate, because nothing changes. You have all these great ideals. You think you can change the world, but ultimately nothing changes and it gets worse.
Keith, thanks for your call. God, Ken, I'm totally depressed now.
You know something? I feel the same way. And I,
you just came back from vacation.
Well, yes. I had a very relaxing time.
Good.
In Luquillo, Puerto Rico.
Good. I'm glad. I'm glad to hear that. Thanks for joining us today.
It was my pleasure.
We appreciate it. You've been listening to Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie. We have run out of time. I appreciate your time today. If you would. So thanks for joining us on All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. This is listener supported, WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. WOSU 820, NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from Fast Signs, using technology to offer a concept-to-completion process for customer sign-buying needs. More information about Fast Signs is available in Westerville at 890-3821 and Columbus at 860-0103.